Billy whispered back. She says she's old and rich, and why shouldn't she employ people to help her when there are so many desperate for work? My Da would have had a lot to say about people who used other people as servants, but there was a leafy smell that flowed between the old lady and all of her staff, which certainly seemed to be affection and mutual respect. Certainly nobody smelled of resentment or envy or even of irritation. It was a good lesson not to generalize principles. We had dinner in the dining room, on an ancient timber table long enough for us and all of the Roundtree ancestors to eat with their elbows out. There was a red ceramic bowl in the center, filled with flowers and tiny floating candles, the reflections of which gleamed softly on the water and on the old, very beautiful silver cutlery. "It looks lovely," I said. Mrs. Roundtree looked pleased. "I sometimes think I shouldn't mind eating bread and water, so long as I was eating off nice china, and there were flowers and candlelight." The room had begun to fill up with real scents of flowers and candle wax, which perfectly blended with the old lady's smells of rosemary, blackberries, and peaches. I noticed Chilly watching her grandmother with faint puzzlement and tried to gently will the old woman to go on talking, guessing that her granddaughter did not often see this side of her. I felt her desire to be closer to Jilly, but she had no idea how to go about it. I reasoned that my willing her to talk was only helping her to do what she wanted anyway. There are so many sad and ugly things in the world that I feel I must try to counterbalance them with whatever beauty I can produce, she said. Setting a pretty table in a world of pain might seem callous given that people are starving and living with dreadful disease, but in trying to create islands of beauty and peace, I feel I'm honouring the dreams of the world. That's a good philosophy, I said sincerely. Mrs. Roundtree flushed a delicate pink. We all have strengths and weaknesses, but we must do what we can with what we have to make the world a better place. I said, My Da says we have to live by our standards and beliefs, no matter what other people do in the world, or even to us. Otherwise, we're living by their standards. She smiled. It is pleasing to hear the wisdom of a father being espoused by his children. I think there are more and more people in the world who seem completely bereft of conscience or any idea of right or wrong. I think that's because people are spending less time thinking about the things they do, Jilly said. Her cheeks were pink, and her sea smell was very strong. Jilly's grandmother sighed and said, Everything moves faster and faster, and sometimes I feel so exhausted with all the running here and there, buying this and that. I want things to slow down. I want there to be time to dawdle and time to dream, especially time to think. Jilly sat forward excitedly. Thinking is out of fashion, she said. No one bothers making up their own mind. They can let magazines and talk show hosts do it for them. Without warning, Jilly's gran started to laugh. What is it? Jilly asked, sounding offended. It's you two and me, Mrs. Roundtree said, giggling like a girl. I sat around with my friends, talking about saving the world when I was your age, and now here I am, still at it. It seems I'll never learn. Jilly laughed too then, but she said, Isn't it better to spend your whole life trying to make the world better than to give up on it? Absolutely, her gran said fervently. To try when there is little hope is a beautiful kind of foolishness. They smiled shyly at one another, and I thought how strange it was that in a matter of days I had heard two separate conversations about saving the world. Maybe all over the world people were having those sorts of thoughts and conversations. On my way home later, I sat alone on the plush leather seat, looking at the back of Samuel's head and feeling good. Whatever walls stood between Jilly and her grandmother had been undermined by our unexpected dinner, and I was gratified to think I had played a part in bringing them together. Jilly admired integrity, and there was no doubt the old woman had it. Jilly had let the gap in their age and the situation with her father and mother create a wall between them, and now the wall had cracked open. I smiled, because I could imagine how the old woman would warm to Da when he came the following night to pick Jilly up. I was beginning to nod off when the car pulled up outside our house. Samuel insisted on walking me to the door, claiming that it was Mrs. Roundtree's request.
"She's an old-fashioned lady," he said with a grin.
"You like her, don't you?" I asked.
"Very much," he said with a smile.
Making my way round to the kitchen door, I almost fell over Wombat, who materialized out of the shadows the way cats do. I stopped to pat him and make a fuss of him, because he'd vanished after our conversation, and I'd begun to worry about him. I thought he might snub me, but he pushed his head against me, marking me affectionately with the scent glands under his chin.
"Hello to you too," I said,
and then I thought to him, "Where have you been for the last couple of days?" He responded with the smell of the sea.
"You don't mean you went all the way to the sea?"
"Cheese smell, yes."
"But it's so far."
Wombat gave out a smug, buttery smell. Then he meowed and produced a sardine scent to tell me that he wanted feeding. I went to the back door with him weaving in and around my legs, almost tripping me up, me thinking I would be the first person who could actually learn why cats did that. I opened the door and was startled to find Aaron Race and Da seated at the kitchen table again, Da halfway through some story about a musician. Neither of them noticed my entrance, and I had the queer urge to back out, but Wombat pushed impatiently past my legs, insisting on being fed. I stepped inside and closed the door. Only then did I see Dita Race sitting a little apart from Da and her husband. This time she wore a blue velvet dress and matching cape, and her hair was drawn into a complex plait at the back of her head. She was fingering a huge sapphire hanging from one earlobe, and my heart gave a little start because she was watching me, her mouth shaped into a wide, frosted pink bow.
"Hello, Alison,"
she greeted me in her husky, confiding voice. I disliked the way she said my name, but I disliked her cement dust and overripe banana smell more. I could have clamped my senses or moved out of range, but increasingly I felt that stopping myself from smelling bad things was like an ostrich sticking its head in the sand. If I could smell something bad, then the badness was there, and I'd better know about it. I got out a tin of cat food, opened it, and dished it onto a saucer as Wombat wove around my legs, purring and offering his approval and encouragement in scents that communicated their meaning as clearly as words.
"Hello, love," Da said at last. "How was dinner with Jilly's grandmother?"
"It was great, but I don't want to interrupt."
Da shook his head. "You're not interrupting. Aaron and Dita just dropped in on their way to somewhere else. I am here so often lately you must feel I am wanting to be part of the family, Alison." The white-haired entrepreneur laughed his beautiful laugh. "But actually I came to persuade your father to do another gig for me."
"What kind of gig?" I bent down to pick up Wombat so I didn't have to look at him, because his lack of an essence smell made me feel uneasy.
"Another charity benefit," Da answered.
Wombat struggled in my arms and gave off an annoyed smell. "I want to eat more," his scent told me. I scratched under his chin, and after a brief grumble he succumbed to pleasure and began to purr. I looked back at Aaron Race and saw his eyes were on Da again, the pupils huge, as if he were looking into darkness rather than light. A chill ran down my spine, and maybe I gave off a scent because Wombat stopped purring.
"Are you all right?" Da asked me. "You look a bit pale."
"I'm just tired," I said. "I'd better go to bed. Don't sign any contract until you read the fine print," I added lightly, as if it were a joke, but I willed a mountain of caution at Da. I let Wombat down and bade them all good night, interested to note that Wombat gave Dita a wide berth before curving back to his food bowl. Later I would ask him why he'd done that, though I suspected I already knew the answer. He could smell her, just as I could, and he didn't like the smell. What had happened in the kitchen filled me with a nameless urgency, and suddenly I could not face having to see Harlan at school the next day. I had to know what made him tick. Instead of going to Shaletown Secondary College next week, as I had decided to do earlier that day, I would go tomorrow. The rumor that Harlan had previously gone to a private school was probably just that, a rumor. When I finally slept, I dreamed again that I was a wolf, sitting on a wide stone sill in a half-crumbled stone wall, looking over the ruined city. The air was thick with scents, but my wolf nose separated them easily. Spoilt milk, rotten meat, and the smell of wet cement dust and banana. The following morning, I called Jilly and told her that I had a routine doctor's appointment in Remington. I didn't want to tell her the truth in case Harlan asked about me. Somehow, I didn't think she would be a good liar. "So, dinner at your place is off?" she asked, sounding disappointed. "No, it's still on. I'll just come off the train at the stop near your place and get a lift home when Dar picks you up. Why don't you come straight from school and meet me at the station?" I added this as if it had just occurred to me. But in fact, I needed to be able to tell her some version of the truth before we got to her grand's, so she wouldn't mention the fake doctor's visit to Dar. "Your Dar isn't driving you to Remington?" "He has a rehearsal," I invented quickly, then said goodbye hastily because someone was knocking at the front door. It was Rona Wojciech, and after letting her in, I escaped upstairs, ostensibly to get ready for school, but in fact, to make preparations for Shale Town. I emptied my piggy bank for the train fare, tipped the school books from my backpack into the bottom of my wardrobe, then stuffed in a light casual coat and some other things. Then I did my hair and put on my uniform. By the time I got downstairs again, Dar and a sleepy-looking mum were listening to Rona talk about reorganizing the exhibition that had been put off. She'd found a new gallery that would be perfect, and a new approach. She gave me a wary look, as if she expected me to suddenly throw a fit and fall to the floor frothing at the mouth, just to spoil another show opening. Rona always took things personally. If a bus was in her way, she felt like the bus driver had stopped there to spite her. She left as soon as she had secured Mum's agreement, refusing coffee or tea. While I ate breakfast, Dar started to tell Mum about Aaron Race's offer the previous night. My ears pricked up. "Don't you want to do it?" Mum asked, in that way she has of always seeming to hear things that are left unsaid better than the things that are said aloud. Dar ran his hand through his hair and sighed. "The trouble is that it's just me he wants. He says the whole band is too big for the venue and the occasion, but I feel it's not fair on the others. I mean, the songs I play are Losing the Rope songs, even though I write most of them." Mum spread her hands like two butterfly wings. "Ask Neil." "Oh, Zambia, he'll say I should do it. They all will," Dar said, but Mum was no longer listening. You could see it in the way she had turned her face from Dar's to the table, where an ant was excavating a pile of crumbs. It was running all round the edges and waving its feelers frantically as if it was sending out semaphore signals to all the other ants. I looked up and saw that Dar had stopped talking and was watching Mum's beautiful, absorbed face with a combination of longing and, strangely, of pity. 20. Getting off the train in Shale Town, I felt that it must be obvious to anyone looking at me that I was wagging school, even though I was wearing my uniform and had a clipboard clutched to my chest. I didn't know exactly where the station was in relation to anything else because Da had always driven us there in the past, but I had picked up a map of Shale Town at the station, and once I'd found a quiet place away from streams of people, I unfolded it and studied it. Shale Town Secondary College was about 12 blocks from the station, most of it straightforward. It looked simple, but I set off with trepidation because I am a genuine map idiot, and I couldn't believe that my enhanced senses would have changed that. I was right. Somehow I turned twice, without noticing, and both times it took me ages to find my way back to the right road. The day had started out grey and dreary, but grew steadily brighter and warmer, until I ended up having to carry my blazer. By the time I got to the school, I had my jumper off as well, but I smoothed my hair and put the blazer back on before I entered the yard. The neater you look, the less likely it is that you will be stopped and questioned by a teacher. I wasn't worried about having the wrong uniform, because there were often kids at our school in different uniform, either new arrivals or visitors. Because of my woeful navigational skills, I arrived later than I intended, and the recess bell was ringing. I gave up my immediate plan of finding a toilet and headed for the door where kids were spilling out into the yard. I calculated that I probably had 15 or 20 minutes of recess in which to find out if Harlan had attended the school and why he had left. If I failed, I would have to hang around until lunchtime to try again. What I was looking for was a lone kid my own age. A group of girls looked right, but I dismissed the idea of approaching them. They were a flock of golden-haired beauties with snooty expressions, and in my experience, exactly the kind to sneer at newcomers or outsiders and enjoy getting the misinformation. I wandered around the outside of the building into a big courtyard in the middle of the school. Some of it was marked into courts, and there were a few people watching a game. I studied the watchers and ended up settling on two plump girls sitting together on a bench at the side of the court. They glanced at me as I approached, and I did a double take because they were identical twins. "Hi," I said brightly. "I was just wondering if someone I knew used to go here. His name was Harlan Sanderson." They exchanged a look. Then the one on the left said, "I don't know any Harlan. What year was he in?" I told her, and she shrugged. "Maybe she'd ask Glad." "Glad?" I echoed. They both pointed to a tall, athletic girl with spectacles who was dribbling the ball along the court. She moved beautifully, and when she went for a goal, I drew in a breath of pleasure because it was such a long shot, and yet she managed it. I found myself exchanging a smile with the two girls, who suddenly looked a lot more friendly. "She's good, isn't she?" said the one who had not yet spoken, sounding exactly like the one who had. I nodded. "That's Glad. Glad home. She's the team captain." I turned back to study the girl, marveling at the names some kids got. "She looks like a year 12. "She is," said the first girl who had spoken, "but she edits the school magazine." The bell for the end of recess rang, and the two girls dashed off before I could ask what Glad Home's status as magazine editor had to do with my question about Harlan. Having no other option, I waited until the older girl was leaving the court, then fell in beside her and asked my question again. She said at once, and decisively, that he'd never attended the school before. "He wasn't a year 11 when he was here," I said doubtfully. "Doesn't matter. I run the school magazine, see?" She shot me a bright glance and saw that I didn't see. "Look, our mag comes out fortnightly, and we always feature a few students each issue. We publish a photo of them and a mini-interview, their thoughts, dreams, etc. A lot of rot most of them talk, but still, if there had been a Harlan Sanderson here, I'd know, because by the end of the year, we've done everyone. And I write all of the stories. But if you want to double-check, they have back copies in the library. The Roving Eye, it's called. Students featured in it each issue are listed on the front page." I didn't need my extended senses to know that Glad Home was not the type to have made a mistake. Having come so far, though, I was determined to be sure that Harlan had not gone to Shaletown Secondary College. It wasn't hard to locate the library, but I was immediately stopped by a librarian, demanding to know what I thought I was doing. She had restless eyes and smelled like burnt potatoes. So I obeyed my instincts and launched into a dull, slow explanation of a project I needed to research before she had the chance to ask who had sent me. It worked. She was one of those quick, impatient people who couldn't bear to dally for more than a second on anything. Soon I was safely between the magazine racks. It was easy to find the Roving Eye. I checked the front covers of the magazine for the first half of the year in which Harlan would have been there. By the time I reached March, I was beginning to accept that he had not been to the school, but I went right through to June. Then I went back and checked the whole of the previous year. No Harlan. I left the school feeling flat and disheartened. The whole trip had been a waste of time. I came out and checked the map again to be sure I was heading the right way back to the station, and my eye fell on the yellow square marked Detention Center. It was easily time enough to visit it and still get the train I needed. In fact, I had to kill some time. I checked the map again, worked out a route, and set off. I was thirsty, and I still needed to go to the toilet. So I went into the first cafe I came to and ordered an orange juice from a young woman with long black hair. She looked spotless and neat, but she emanated an off-putting dirty fridge smell that stopped me buying anything else. I paid for the juice, went to the toilet, then collected my drink from the fridge. I asked for a glass and some ice, and the woman looked as if she would refuse, but a man poked his head out from the door behind her and said cheerfully that he'd get the ice. This seemed to annoy the woman. She took off her apron, threw it on the counter, and went out of the shop. The man came back with a glass of ice. I took it to one of the plastic tables, poured out the orange juice and drank two-thirds of it straight down.
"You wagging school?"
the man asked. He had come round the front of the counter and was leaning against it, watching me through half-closed eyes.
"No,"
I said frostily. He grinned and tapped his nose.
"Hated school, I did. Wagged all the time, and look at me now."
He gestured at the shop with his sad sort of joviality. I shifted to a thinner part of my screen and took in his mouse cage smell. It wasn't the smell of a dirty mouse cage, so I gave in to curiosity and asked, "What did you do when you wagged?"
"Oh, lots of things. Went fishing off the end of the pier with a mate. Sometimes I went to the industrial estate to spot pigeons' nests so I could come back and hunt them at night. You can only get them at night because you can blind them with a torch."
"You killed them?" I asked in horror.
"No way," he said. "That's how you catch them. I used to keep a flock. Got wild ones to breed with the tame ones I'd bought. Beauty, some of them."
"What happened to them? Do you still have them?" I asked. He gave a laugh.
"Nah, missus didn't like them."
He gestured to the counter, and I supposed he meant that the bad-tempered woman was his wife.
"Horrible disease thing, she reckons. She's got a thing about germs, you see. Nah, I sold them all. Give them away. Life never works out the way you expect it, eh?"
"I guess," I said, wondering why adults always acted as if something had stopped them from doing what they wanted to do, when mostly it was they themselves who didn't live up to their dreams. Just the same, I couldn't help pitying him a bit when the woman returned and asked him in a waspish voice if he'd finished cleaning out the oven yet. I was fascinated to notice that his mouse cage smell changed when she entered, becoming thicker and less pleasant. She was still pecking hard at him when I finished the juice and left. The high, dingy yellow wall that surrounded the block of buildings that were Shaletown Detention Center looked even more prison-like than it had when Aya and her family had been inside. How could any government justify locking little kids and even babies in such a place? Had any of those politicians who approved its creation ever come to look at it? Had they tried to imagine how it would be if they or their families had to stay indefinitely in such a place? Not so long ago, I had heard a politician arguing that the women and children ought to be let out to live with volunteers while the fathers and uncles and brothers remained in the detention center. Even that seemed horrible to me. How would that woman have felt if it was her husband locked up while she was free? How would her children feel to be without their father for so long?
"You wonder how anyone could build something so ugly," said an old woman who'd come quietly to stand beside me.
She wore a rosette that announced she was a protester and was obviously stationed at the protest set up on the lawn closer to the entrance. A fleeting but painfully vivid memory of Aya came to me, her satin brown hands clasped together in her lap in the brightly lit white-painted visitor's room, her huge dark eyes that had never stopped pleading. "Maybe it just reflects the ugliness of the minds of the people who dreamed it up," I said savagely.
"Do you know someone in there?"
the old woman asked gently. "I used to know a girl. She and her family were refused asylum. They were sent back." All of a sudden, tears were spilling down my cheeks.
"Oh, my dear, come and sit down," the old woman said. "I've got some tea in a thermos."
I went with her, unable to stop crying. Memories of Aya were all mixed up with my disappointment about the whole long trip to Shaletown being a total waste. I would have to go back to school and be pursued by Harlan again, without any idea of why my senses regarded him as a danger. By the time I managed to get myself under control, my face felt swollen and my eyes were puffy and itchy. I felt vaguely embarrassed by my outburst, but aside from the old woman, who had introduced herself as Rose Cobb, the only other person at the protest stand was a huge, muscular, slow-witted young man with strangely beautiful face and a halo-like mass of soft golden curls. He stared at me fixedly, and I might have felt uneasy except for his smell, which was a combination of baby shampoo and toffee and something that reminded me a lot of Luke's smell. The old woman introduced him as Davy. I was afraid he would want to shake my hand, but he just stared at me even harder, as if he were trying to look through my face into my head. Then he gave a funny bending nod that seemed a bit like a bow and announced that someone called Simon had said he should go home. Watching him lumber away, Rose Cobb said gently that he lived close by in a caravan on the industrial estate. "He's a lovely boy," she added sadly. I drank the tea she poured and told her my name as I sat down gingerly on one of the little fold-up stools. "It's ages since I last came here. I didn't realize it would make me so angry." Rose Cobb sighed. "Anger is a powerful force. I ought to know, because I spent most of my life being ruled by it. I was angry at my parents for bringing me to this country, angry at my friends for not loving me as I thought I should be loved, angry at my husband for not being what I thought he should be, and at my children for preferring their own lives to mine. The people here taught me all about the futility of anger." "The refugees?" I asked. She shook her head. "The protesters. I live across the road, you see. I'd see the protesters coming with their placards and petitions, and I would glare at them through my curtains, a bunch of scruffy, drug-taking hippies and dough bludgers, I used to think. Max would say they were just people protesting about something that troubled them. I dare say I had some smart, nasty answer for him. The truth was that I didn't understand why they were there, because I didn't think of refugees as people." "So what happened?" She sighed. "Max died. I was angry at him over that, too. Then one day, a month or so after his funeral, I was sitting here feeling angry about everything as usual, and all that lifetime of rage seemed to boil up in me and turn me into a lightning bolt that needed earthing. So I went across the road to give those dull bludgers the edge of my tongue." She laughed. "Oh, how righteous I felt. But before I could say a word, some young mother pushed her baby into my hands and asked if I wouldn't mind holding him because she had to pour the tea. She'd mistaken me for one of them, and I was so taken aback that I just, well, I held the baby." She laughed. "It was winter and very cold, and none of those young people seemed to be wearing enough clothes. The baby was sneezing and sniffling, and I was struck by how insubstantial it was. It made me think of my own children. I felt such a tenderness for them in that moment that it was like a little earthquake inside me. It was as if I hadn't understood how much I loved them until that second." She laughed again. "When the mother took her baby back, she handed me a mug of tea. I took a sip of it, expecting it to be horrid overbrewed stuff like it is in most cafes, but it was good. Then one of the young men asked the woman with the baby about a letter she'd received from someone she'd visited in the center. She got it out and read from it. It was so... Well, I'm sure you had letters from your friend, so you know. I found myself, for the first time, imagining how it must feel to have travelled here fleeing from famine or drought or political upheaval or persecution, and all at once I understood why a woman with a baby would stand out in the cold to protest. It was because she had the imagination to empathise with the refugees. I have heard so many stories since then, many far worse than that of the person who wrote that letter. But it is that one I remember best, because it broke down the wall of my ignorance and raked open my heart. I asked that young woman, Gwenny, her name was, how one went about writing to refugees. She told me the name of an organization, and before I knew it, I was visiting a woman my own age who..." She stopped and shook her head with a prim little tightening of her mouth. Then she sighed. "Poor Max. I am a better person than the woman he married. I would change that if I could. Go back and be a kinder and more compassionate wife to him. And that's the one thing you can't do, is it? You can only go forward and be the best person you can. Anyway, what I have learned is that anger doesn't help anyone, least of all the person who feels it."
"Doesn't that make you angry?" I nodded towards the detention center.
Rose Cobb studied the yellow wall for a moment. "A lot of volunteers do feel angry to start with. Being powerless to make the authorities see or care fills them with rage and frustration and makes them want to smash something just to get someone to listen. Maybe it's because of a lifetime of anger that I know there's no good in it. Anger is a sickness that afflicts anything and anyone it touches. The protesters who stay committed are not those who feel angry."
"You think of anger as a sickness?" I asked, thinking of Serenity.
I think it is a sickness of the soul, the old woman said. I was disappointed, and maybe she saw it, for she said, I'm not talking about religion, Alison. When I say soul, I mean no more than your essence. I shivered, because I had got into the habit of thinking I could smell people's essences, but it seemed too prideful and eerie to think I could smell people's souls. The old woman chuckled. You won't believe it, but people normally think I'm aloof. I think you're very kind, I said. She shook her head. Max would have scolded me for speechifying. Rose Cobb sighed. He deserved a better wife than he had. I'm sure he loved you, I said. Oh, he did, but that was more due to his sweet nature than mine. She poured herself another half cup of tea and offered me more, but I remembered that I had a train to catch. Before I left, Rose Cobb pointed out to her house, telling me to call in if I came back to visit any of the refugees. I was almost at the train station when I heard the train coming. I was horrified because if I missed it, Jilly would go home and Dow would arrive to collect her, and she would tell him I hadn't come back from my doctor's appointment in Remington yet. Then he and Jilly and her gran would all know I had lied. I ran. Flinging myself into the seat in the first compartment I came to, I sat gasping and trying to catch my breath for ages. Two little kids seated opposite stared at me as if I was in the midst of some hideous transformation, and I resisted the urge to make a face, because their mother had the exact same expression of alarm on her face. But instead of smelling like boiled potatoes and corn like her children, she had an unpleasant old flower water smell. How would she react if I told her that her soul smelled of old flower water? Jilly was waiting for me at the station, and I asked worriedly if she'd mentioned my doctor's appointment to her gran. I was lucky. She shook her head and, seeing my relief, asked, Why wouldn't you want me to say anything about it to her? I took a deep breath, trying to decide how much to tell her. Because I didn't go to Remington, and there was no doctor's appointment. I didn't tell you the truth this morning, because I didn't want you to have to lie if Harlan asked where I was. But where did you go then? I told her about going to the refugee center in Shale Town and about meeting with Rose Cobb, which led into the story of Aya, and my belief that whatever was wrong with Serenity stemmed from what had happened to her and her family. But how does this fit with your sister acting strange at the library? Jilly asked. I don't know, I admitted. I guess it was just because she acted paranoid that I felt she was hiding something. Harrison will find out, Jilly said. As I had hoped, she had jumped at the conclusion that I had gone to Shale Town to visit the detention center because of my concern about Serenity. Then she said, Harlan did ask about you. He said you hadn't mentioned any doctor's appointment to him, and I asked why should you have? She frowned. It's weird how possessive he acts about you. She hesitated. Then she added, He said he had a date on the weekend with you. He sort of cornered me, I said wearily. I made it for the middle of Saturday in Eastland Mall. I don't get it, Jilly said. Why are you so nervous of just telling him straight out that you don't want to go out with him? Oh, I forgot, there was a notice about the holidays. She began to rummage in her bag. After a minute, red-faced and muttering, she gave up, saying she must have left it in her locker. I am so disorganized. I swear it's my natural state. I keep thinking when I do this or that, I'll finally be able to get organized. But of course then there's always something else to get in the way. I grinned sympathetically. The thing is to tell yourself this is life, and chaos is part of it. You sound like some sort of wise guru. Maybe that's what you're going to be when you grow up. I grinned. All right, so I was raving on. Yeah, but in a good way, Jilly said, and we both laughed. That was great last night when you came to dinner, she went on. You had this amazing effect on my grandmother. Usually she's so stuffy and disapproving. I didn't have an effect, I said. We did, the three of us. I think the dynamics between the three of us produced the right chemistry for her to talk. Yeah, but it's been the same ever since. Jilly shook her head. I mean, we actually talked over breakfast this morning, and she made me laugh. She made me laugh too. I said, spooky.
Idiot,
Jilly retorted. We had just reached her gran's house. Dar had already parked in the drive, and I was relieved all over again that Jilly had not said anything about the false doctor's appointment to her gran. Mrs. Roundtree and Dar were eating sponge cake and drinking tea in a pretty little conservatory that I had not seen the night before.
Hello, Alison,
Dar said. Then he held out his hand to Jilly.
We meet again, Jilly. I'm not sure if I mentioned how much I enjoyed your playing the other night. You have a fine technique.
Jilly reddened with pleasure.
It's lovely to see you again, Alison, her grandmother told me warmly. McCall has been telling me that your mother is a painter.
I stifled a grin to see that her cheeks were pink. Dar has a visible swoon range.
Oh, Dar, you kissed her hand, I laughed when we were driving off down the road. That's so old-fashioned.
Millicent Roundtree is an old-fashioned type of lady, Dar said with dignity, and she liked it.
She loved it, Jilly said, and flushed scarlet when she heard the wistfulness in her voice. That broke me up and I laughed until Jilly forgot to be mortified and elbowed me hard. Dar pretended not to notice any of this, and only when we had quietened down did he look sideways and ask how the school day had gone, which wiped the smile right off my face. Jilly told him about her own day, making it sound as if she was speaking for both of us, and without her ever actually uttering a lie. It was pretty impressive, and I told her so when we got home and went upstairs to my room.
I'm not sure I want to be congratulated for being a good liar, Jilly said primly as we came through the door.
Then she saw Serenity's half of the room, and her mouth fell open.
What is this?
Serenity's side of the bedroom, I said. Jilly gazed about, then finally she said, I see now why you're so worried about her. This is a bit much, isn't it? You really think that business in Shaletown is behind this?
I don't know, but
I stopped because Jessie was yelling out for us to come and eat. We had a great dinner with Dar telling jokes and stories about gigs, but I saw Jilly watching Serenity speculatively a couple of times, and it didn't surprise me that she brought her up again as soon as we went back upstairs. But I answered non-committally, uneasy talking about Serenity when she might walk in. Jilly went back to lecturing me about Harlan. It's like the lady said, just say no. Come on, it's easy. Try it with me. No. Very funny. I made a face at her. But seriously, Alison, I just can't believe you're so timid. It's not like you'll pine away and die.
Thanks a lot.
She grinned. You can't just keep dodging him. I'm hoping he'll get the hint, I said. I wouldn't bet on. Oh, hey, I forgot. My grandmother wants to take us somewhere for my birthday next month.
Us?
Us, as in me and you, Jilly said. She wants us to go to the city to see a ballet and stay a night in a hotel. Usually she takes me on my own, but, well, maybe she liked the dynamics the other night as well. Anyway, she said to ask, so I'm asking.
Well, I'd love to, but
it would be my grandmother's treat, Jilly said. I flushed.
I was going to say that I don't know if I have the right clothes.
You can borrow something of mine. I've got millions of clothes that will fit you better than they fit me, because you're smaller. There was a tinge of anger in her voice, and, fleetingly, Jilly's lovely smell was tainted with the sort of odour that comes from shells when you keep them and forget to wash them. I thought of what Rose Cobb had said about anger being a kind of sickness. You know, maybe it's not that your mum doesn't remember your size, I said. Maybe she just can't bear to think of you getting older without her being there to see it. Jilly darted me a surprised look. She says that in letters, but how come she has to be away if I matter so much?
What does she do anyway? I asked.
Jilly shrugged. She's the private assistant of some big manager of a company. He's supposedly grooming her to do his job when he retires in a couple of years. And then she says she'll get to stay home all the time like he does and send other people gallivanting off. She's so fanatical about making us secure. It's because my dad left. She sighed. Sometimes it feels like I'm living in some country that's been devastated by a war that had nothing to do with me. She sighed again and suggested we do our homework. It seemed only a few minutes had passed before Dar was knocking at the door, telling us it was time for him to drive Jilly home. I went along for the ride, and after we had seen her safely to her door, With a big sweet-scented bunch of flowers from our garden for her grandmother, we headed back home. As we crossed the city, I saw the old derelict from the bus sitting in the doorway of a closed shop and glaring out at the street. He was still wearing his filthy leather coat, and he probably had the same reeking pad of newspapers under his unraveling jumper. He looked up as the car swished by and spat, and I thought that if Rose Cobb was right about anger being a sickness of the soul, then the old derelict clearly had a terminal case of hate infection. I turned back to catch a final glimpse of him, but he was hidden by the shadows. To the rest of the world, the old man was a shadow dweller, just as Aya and her family had been. People made invisible by other people who didn't want to see them and what they meant. If Rose Cobb was there then, I would have told her that I thought indifference was a sickness too.
"Hard day?" Das said, sympathetically.
"A bit," I said, feeling more guilty about lying to him than about wagging. But how could I explain about the trip to Shale Town without going into my extended powers? I would have liked to tell him what I thought about Serenity, too, but that could wait until after Monday, when Harrison did his detective act, though I couldn't see how her furtive behavior outside the library could be connected to her anger over what had happened to Aya. 21. I slept badly and woke with a blurred memory of a dream that refused to be recalled. I felt depressed and uneasy in the knowledge that I had to meet Harlan Sanderson in Eastland Mall, having failed to learn anything useful about him in Shale Town. I would have no choice but to continue being evasive, unless I took Jilly's advice and told him that I wasn't interested. The trouble was that he had made his interest in me so obvious that he was bound to feel humiliated, and Mrs. Barker had seemed to think that should be avoided. On the way downstairs, I heard Neil Stone's voice, but the pleasure I felt at seeing the big musician faded when I entered the kitchen and saw his face and Dar's.
"Don't be a mug," Neil was saying, sounding genuinely annoyed. "It's money and you need it, man. None of us would stand in the way of that. You've got to eat and take care of your family. Just do it. It's not like you're signing a recording contract."
"But we're a band," Das said.
"So we are, and who says this changes that? Christ, I was playing at my sister's wedding a month ago, and you didn't see me agonizing over leaving you guys out of it." "She wasn't paying you," Dar protested. "Well, that's true, bloody cow." He said this so fondly that Dar laughed, and suddenly the tension dissolved. "That's more like it," Neil said. "Just take the job, McColl. Pay some bills and get Jesse the computer he needs."
"Mum needs some framing done, too," Miranda added, so sweetly that I knew she must be wanting to ask Dar for something as well.
"There you are," Neil said, "out of the mouth of a babe."
Miranda giggled. "What's up?" I asked Dar. He sighed, and his smile faded.
"It's the charity function that Aaron mentioned the other night, but he wants me as a solo performer. I should insist that he take all of us or none of us," Dar said morosely.
"Why?" Neil demanded. "It's hardly like it'll be a mainline concert. The waiters will be lording it over you as usual, and you'll be told to play more quietly so people can hear themselves chewing."
They both laughed at this, but they were still talking about the gig when I left 20 minutes later. I decided to walk to the mall instead of taking a bus. It was a crisp, bright day, and there was still plenty of time. I set off on a route that would bring me down one of my favorite streets, lined with enormous old cypress trees, their twisted trunks and branches agonized-looking. I was halfway along it when I spotted Sari coming out of the milk bar, licking an ice cream. She was wearing luridly tie-dyed skin-tight jeans and a tie-dyed petticoat over the top of a lacy T-shirt and had an enormous flowered shawl wrapped around her shoulders.
"Hi, Alizon. Isn't it a great day?" she said when I came level.
"Blissful," I agreed. "Where are you headed?"
"Going with the flow," Sari said languidly. "Currents flow all around us, even though we don't see them. If you don't fight them, just, you know, hang loose and relax, they'll sweep you somewhere interesting, or even somewhere you're supposed to go, but you don't know it."
For some reason, her words brought back into focus the elusive dream of the previous night. I had been in the street, running along the front of the refugee center in Shale Town, and it had been night. The enormous, simple-minded protester I'd met through Rose Cobb had been with me, but in the dream his eyes had been less sweetly vacant than in reality, and his golden halo of hair had shone with its own light.
"I can smell the wrongness," he said. "You can smell it too, can't you?"
"No," I said.
"Yes, you can. You smell it in people. The wrongness is inside them, making them sick and bad."
Then he had vanished.
"Are you okay, Alizon?"
Sari's soft voice broke through the glassy screen of strangeness that the memory of the dream had evoked. "Davy," I thought. "Davy" had been his name. I looked at her.
"Sari, do you think a person could visit you in a dream?"
She tipped her head to one side, as if studying a painting, and said tranquilly, "I think there is this country made up of all the dreams people have when they sleep, and it's constantly changing and reshaping as people wake or dream something different. And if you were, what does Harrison call it? Oh, yes, lucid dreaming. Do you know what that is?
You know you're dreaming?"
"Yeah, well, if you were lucid dreaming, you could visit a bit of that country formed by other people's dreams." It was a strange, lovely idea, but I didn't seriously think Davy had visited my dreams to tell me he knew I could smell wrongness. Like the dream of Harlan whispering that he knew what was inside me, it was no more than a prod from my subconscious. But what had he been trying to tell me? Something about Harlan and how he smelled. On impulse, I asked Sari if she thought wrongness could have a smell.
"You mean like an orange gone rotten inside where you can't see it?"
"No," I began, then stopped, struck by the thought that if Harlan did smell like something rotten, what did it mean if the smell came from his essence, and not just from a specific memory, as I had been imagining?
"It means his soul is rotten," Rose Cobb's voice whispered.
I shivered. Imagine if you could smell that there was something wrong about a person, just like you could smell rot in an orange. I looked at Sari, and found her staring at me, her eyes wide and frightened. I was shocked to see that she had crushed the ice cream cone in her grip.
"You can smell it? In me?"
she whispered. Bewildered but wanting to comfort her, I stopped on the verge of touching her, but without warning, Sari caught hold of my hand. Images began to flash into my mind. A young, ginger-haired man smiling, sliding his arms around a pretty, laughing woman. She smiling flirtatiously, and then her face changing. She began to struggle and look frightened. She turned to me and cried out in a queer, muffled voice, "Run and get Rosa! Get Rosa, please!" The terror in me, Sari's terror, grew until I felt faint, but the images kept flying through my mind. I saw the man injecting something into the woman's arm. She was struggling and crying out, but he was stronger. She weakened and became passive. The man smiled at me, his face greedy and triumphant. Then Sari let me go. She backed up against the window of a hairdressing shop and began clawing at her face. I noticed people inside, staring out at us. Shamed and alarmed, I stepped closer to Sari, and without any warning, she started to scream. My heart gave a great jerk of fright, and now it was I who reeled back. Sari went on screaming, letting each terrible, long, piercing shriek unwind to a thin, shrill note before she hitched in a raggedy breath and screamed again. After a few seconds, she slumped to her knees, and her screams became grunting, gasping sounds. There were livid, bloody scratches down both cheeks where she had raked them with her nails. I had never been more frightened or felt more helpless in my whole life.
"What the hell's going on here?"
A red-faced man in a ponytail came out of the shop. He had a black leather apron on and held scissors and a comb.
"I'll call the police if you keep this up. Go somewhere else and take your filthy drugs."
I fought to gather my wits. "Sir, we didn't... My friend is having some sort of fit." I gestured to Sari, and he saw, as I had, that a white froth was beginning to bubble from her mouth. His face changed, reflecting pity as well as disgust.
"I'll call an ambulance. Try to calm her down, and don't let her bite her tongue."
Sari had been trying to scream in between retching and coughing, but now she hunched forward and began to rock and moan and mutter in between gasping cries.
I was afraid to touch her because it seemed that had only made it worse. So I stood where I was, babbling anything I could think of that might calm her down. "It's all right, Sari. They're calling a doctor. Just try to... I stopped, because I didn't know what to tell her. I was wondering if she had taken drugs because of what I'd seen when I touched her. Only the visions had not been of her. After an eternity, I heard the sound of an ambulance. By this time, Sari was just rocking and grunting.
"We were just talking," I told the medic, as he thumbed her eyelids open. She seemed to have fallen into some sort of stupor now, and sat trance-like and limp on the pavement.
"Had she taken any drugs?" the other medic asked me. Before I could answer, the first medic said, "No drugs. Shock."
They both looked at me, and I couldn't think of a thing to say. The medic with the notepad asked me her second name and address and the name of her parents, none of which I knew. Admitting this seemed to make the two medics deeply suspicious, though of what I couldn't imagine. They took my name and address down, but refused to let me ride to the hospital with the ambulance. They half-lifted Sari to get her in, and her hands flopped down their backs as loosely as the arms of a rag doll. After the ambulance had driven away, I went to a phone booth and called Da. He said he'd come and take me to the hospital. The medics had at least consented to tell me where they would take Sari. It was the same hospital where I had lain in a coma for a month. I called Jilly while I waited for Da. But the housekeeper said she'd gone out with her grandmother. She asked if I wanted to leave a message, but I decided against it, not being able to think of any way to describe what had happened that would not alarm Jilly's grandmother. I said in as calm a voice as I could manage that I would call back later. At the hospital, a nurse told us that Sari was under sedation, but that we could wait and talk to the doctor when he came on his rounds in an hour. They wouldn't let us go in and sit with her because we were not relatives. Dar stopped me when I would have argued with the reception nurse, telling me that she was only doing her job and that we would wait. He went to get us some cold drinks, and that was when I remembered that Harrison had given me his phone number. I dug it out of my wallet, called him, and told him what had happened. Then I said, "The hospital wants to know her name and address so they can contact her family."
"Oh, hell," Harrison said. "Listen, I'll get a bus down. Okay, can you wait?"
I tried to make him tell me the number for her parents, but he just reiterated that he would come down and hung up. I went back to the waiting room, wondering why he hadn't sounded all that surprised at Sari's attack. Da handed me a cold box of juice. I took it and burst into tears. Da gathered me up and held me. Instead of being overwhelmed by his feelings, I felt only his love for me, as warm and soothing as a hot bath.
"What happened to your friend is not your fault," Da said gently.
I heard his words as a warm vibration against my cheek. It felt so safe in his arms, but I knew that if I stayed for a few more minutes, his painless and soothing concern would begin to give way to other thoughts and feelings which would cause me discomfort. So I moved reluctantly out of the circle of his arms, using my need for a tissue as an excuse.
"How do you feel?" Da asked gently.
"I'm okay." I looked up at him, wondering suddenly if I was okay. I seemed to have done a lot of crying the last few days. "Da," I began, but there was a footstep behind us. It was Harrison, who explained that he had caught a taxi rather than waiting for a bus.
22.
Harrison wanted to know in detail what had happened. "The men who called the ambulance thought she had taken drugs," I said.
"She doesn't take drugs," Harrison said dismissively.
"What were you talking about before?" she started screaming. I told him, and when I got to the bit about the dream, he nodded decisively.
"That's it."
"That's what?" I asked, feeling irrationally angry at him.
"The trigger," Harrison said, looking sympathetic rather than annoyed at my snappy tone. "I guess Jilly might not have mentioned it, but Sari, well, the doctors say she's schizophrenic. They claim attacks occur because of something that triggers a chemical imbalance that makes her imagine things." "I'm sure once she's given the drugs to correct the imbalance, she'll be fine," Dad told me.
Harrison frowned, and it was not the frown of a boy, but the frown a doctor might give someone who disagreed with his diagnosis.
I've read a lot of literature on schizophrenia, and I've talked on the internet with some people who suffer it, and also with people who live with them. Sari doesn't fit the bill. Even her doctor admits there are anomalies. What do you think is wrong with her? I asked.
Something bad happened when Sari was very small, to do with how her mother died. She believes that whatever it was caused her to be infected by a sickness that's contagious. Not a sickness of the body, but a sickness of the spirit that she calls wrongness. A sort of metaphysical corruption. He switched his calm grey gaze to me. When you asked about people smelling the wrongness, Alison, Sari would have taken that to mean you smelled the wrongness in her.
She said that, but I didn't, I burst out. They both stared at me. I mean, that wasn't what I was saying.
Of course not, Thou said. You were just talking about a dream. Harrison is only saying that what you said made your friend imagine that her sickness was apparent to you, and this set off her attack.
It's called an episode, Harrison corrected gently, with the same mild authority as before.
But there is something more. You see, Sari has this sickness she carries under control, but she has to fight to keep it that way, so that it cannot infect anyone else. When Alison talked of smelling wrongness, Sari would have believed the wrongness had become active in her without her being aware of it. Her greatest horror is that she'll infect someone else, you see. That's what set off her episode.
You talk as if you believe she's infected, Dar said.
Harrison pushed a wedge of straw-coloured hair from his forehead.
It's easy for the doctors to dismiss what Sari believes as delusional, but it could also be that Sari's delusion is a genuine perception, just one other people than they have.
Country of the blind, Das said, with a strange certainty, and Harrison nodded.
Exactly. It was seeing how useless conventional treatment with schizophrenia drugs was to Sari that made us, me, Jilly and Raoul, decide to try simply believing that she had a sickness other people couldn't perceive. It might interest you to know that since then, Sari has had far fewer episodes, despite Dr. Austin's insistence that she should be on drugs all the time to control her episodes.
Dr. Austin? I murmured, wondering if I had misheard.
He's Sari's doctor, Harrison said. His specialty is mental patients. He's been treating her since she was a child. Sari dislikes him because he insists on medicating her after an episode, which weakens her will and makes it harder to control the sickness. We didn't bring her to hospital anymore, because after drug treatment she's like a zombie for weeks, sometimes months, until she's wrestled the sickness back into submission.
I didn't know, I whispered, understanding that in calling for an ambulance, I had sent her to Dr. Austin. Chill stole through me, because if anyone smelled of wrongness, it was him. Harrison looked at me, misunderstanding my dismay.
Alison, what happened? Isn't it your fault? And Sari will tell you that when she can. But right now, the most important thing is to offer her belief. I'll wait here till she wakes, and with luck, Raoul will come and we'll be able to talk to her before Dr. Austin arrives. If she's calm, we might be able to insist he gives her a smaller dose of drugs.
He hesitated. It might be better if you leave visiting her till another time.
All right, I said, getting to my feet. My voice sounded jerky.
On the way home, I kept seeing Sari's horrified face as she had backed away from me, understanding only now that she had not been afraid of me, but of infecting me with the wrongness she believed that she carried. Except it wasn't she who smelled of rottenness. It was the doctor who was supposed to be treating her, and Harlan. I stifled a gasp at the realization that I had completely forgotten about the meeting I had arranged with Harlan at the mall. There was no chance that he would still be there, even if I had been willing to ask Dad to drive me, and I couldn't call to explain, because I didn't know Harlan's phone number. I was still worrying about it when I crept into bed an hour later, but I was so tired that I quickly fell asleep and slipped bonelessly into the dream of being a wolf in a dark, crumbling city that smelled of rot. At one point in the dream, I came upon a human, a poor, frail, terrified thing she seemed to my wolf senses, and yet I had the overwhelming feeling that it was my job to protect her and her frail kind.
Yet how could I protect them from a sickness of the spirit? The first thing I saw when I came downstairs in the morning was a note on the bench telling me to call Jim.